Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give a talk here. It's indeed a pleasure to give a presentation at this symposium in honor of Glendon, who has made incredible contributions over the years. I haven't had the pleasure to work with him directly, but certainly well aware of all of his contributions, and they will have a lasting influence for many decades to come. My talks fits very well after what Diana talked about, and that we've become quite interested in climate change impacts and modeling them. In our case, we're looking at how climate impacts might influence not only recharge and such processes, but also things like lake levels, river flows, groundwater table levels, etc. And our goal was to kind of wrap everything together in a modeling framework that tightly couples all of these processes in three dimensions. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Jeremy Chen and Huntai Huang, who are two of my PhD students that are working on this topic, as well as a research professor in my group, Youngjin Park, who has largely been working tirelessly at enhancing the code and adding new processes, because as we go larger in scale, the computational effort gets larger and larger. Martin Ross is a professor in our department who is a quaternary geologist, and putting together the geology and hydraulic properties at the scale of, in our case, all of Canada is a huge, huge effort, and he has really been instrumental in interfacing and bringing into the picture the Geological Survey of Canada, because without a team effort, these things could not be done. Dick Peltier and his postdoc, Jonathan Gula, we've been working with them. They've been producing the downscale forecast of climate change at very high resolution over our entire modeling domain. I might mention that Dick is a very well-known climate, both paleoclimate and future climate modeler, and he is one of the co-authors of the latest IPCC report. So I think the evidence is pretty much out there that global warming is happening. Of course, population will continue to grow, which means water demand will continue to grow, which at the same time probably means that water quality is going to decline. So we became interested in what might the impacts on surface and subsurface water resources, and hopefully the kinds of calculations we do may have some impact on policy development, etc. So this is just a cartoon of, I'll describe our modeling framework just in words. I don't want to show a bunch of equations, etc., because I think most people here are more or less familiar with the equations. We call it an integrated modeling approach, in which we include the surface water regime in a physically based manner using partial differential equations. The subsurface we include in 3D using 3D form of Richards equation, the mixed form valid above and below the water table. By integrated, I mean we solve all of these equations with land surface processes included. We solve them all simultaneously at each time step. So if precipitation occurs, the water can infiltrate where it chooses to infiltrate. It can enter as recharge in the groundwater system, or it could flow laterally, maybe down a hill slope, and it could reemerge as surface water once again. So all of this sort of happens naturally according to the physics and the gradients which drive the processes. But we're also interested in things like solute transport, contaminant transport, for example, from land surface applications or subsurface spills. So contaminants in our model, when you transport them by the advection dispersion equations on the surface and subsurface regimes, a contaminant could form a groundwater plume which discharges into the stream, and then we can calculate the concentrations in the stream. More recently, we have added heat transport or thermal energy transport, in which case we solve the equations on the land surface and the subsurface simultaneously again, to calculate stream temperatures or subsurface groundwater temperatures. And the model then is driven by the ambient air temperature as well as incoming long and short wave solar radiation. And now we're taking the next sort of step to take a climate model such as WRF, the Weather Forecasting and Research Model, and coupling it into our hydrogeosphere modeling framework. So this, I don't want to go through the whole list, but these are sort of the processes that are currently implemented in hydrogeosphere. Diffusion wave equation, which is looks like Richard's equation. It's a shallow water equation describing surface flow, whether it be overland flow or stream flow. Richard's equation plus ET in the typical way it's incorporated in land surface models. You can include things like macro pores, so on and so forth. It is a control volume funded element metal model, so it gives you the flexibility to include these processes in a framework which the media may be heterogeneous, topography is highly variable, et cetera, et cetera. It is a very data-hungry model, which in our case, in many parts of Canada, there is no data, so we have to work with geologists, et cetera, and estimate. But given that it's a physically based model, for example, hydraulic conductivity of a given material, we can estimate what it is where we don't have measurements, at least between an upper and lower bound. So that's why we've taken this physically based approach as opposed to a typical lumped or semi-lumped hydrologic modeling approach. So now, working with climate models, Diana had mentioned that there is a huge amount of uncertainty in particular precipitation estimates coming out of climate models. So at present, we're working with two climate models. One is the WRF model I mentioned previously, which is increasingly being used for regional scale climate modeling and downscaling, using WRF to downscale from a global GCM. In our case, WRF is being downscaled or embedded within the NCAR model, CCSM. And being from Canada, we're also using the Canadian Regional Climate Model, CRCM, which is embedded in CGCM3. WRF, this is Peltier's computations, it's being run over the Canadian landmass at a resolution of 30 kilometers out to the next century, CRCM is being run at a resolution of 45 kilometers. So we're using the output from those models to drive our hydrogeosphere surface subsurface model. So here's the model domain. So it's from coast to coast to coast, and the southern boundary is based on a topographic divide. Assuming that groundwater divides and surface water divides coincide, but I think many of us now recognize that is not true. Certainly when you go deeper, groundwater can cross surface water divides, but we have to stop the model somewhere. We need land cover information, not only for ET type calculations, but also to assign surface runoff Manning's coefficients, for example, to insert into the diffusion wave equation. So here's a map of the land cover. And again, it's highly variable. And when we build a finite element mesh, it has to be fine enough to incorporate this type of spatial variability. Now, we have to spin the model up from somewhere, some starting condition. So what we did was we took the precipitation, averaged it over this time period, and the pattern looks something like this. And then we put that into the model. We started out with water table at some arbitrary guess depth across the landmass, zero surface water in the model, so no Great Lakes, no nothing. We run the model for a very long time to spin it up, and then it calculates the river flows, the lake levels, depths to the water table, etc., which we can then compare to measurements that we might have at hand. And these are the major rivers that we chose as, let's call them, calibration targets, and we chose these gauging stations, and we averaged the river flows over that same time frame, and then we could compare to what the model calculated to what we had observed. Again, the near-surface geology becomes extremely important in these calculations. This just shows a sediment map that was published some time ago. It's very relatively crude for our purposes. So working with the Geological Survey of Canada and Martin Ross, based on his geological knowledge and their geological knowledge, we tried to refine this map, certainly for the upper soils, the unconsolidated sediments, And then we go down to a depth of sea level minus 500 meters, so the sedimentary and crystalline rocks. And this just shows the surficial geology, just sort of the upper region that was put together from that effort. And we've converted the geology, if you will, into high K and low K, K being the hydraulic conductivity. So this is another type of input we need in the model at this scale. We have permafrost. Where there's permafrost, permeability or hydraulic conductivity is reduced. We have to have a 3D distribution of permafrost. And this came from some of Dick Pelche, and this is a former postdoc, their work on paleo modeling. And it turns out that what they modeled for the distribution of permafrost actually agrees quite well with where there is data available. So you put it all together and you get something like this for the geology. It doesn't really show up in great detail here, but we saw the surface map, and here's a fence diagram showing the geology. So it's fairly crude, but as time goes on, in fact, the Geological Survey of Canada, this project has led them to a project to collect data from the provinces across Canada and put it into a web-based database so that people could extract it and so on. And because where there's no people, basically we have no data in Canada. And that would be a very important resource. This just shows a finite element mesh. This is we've refined it since the time this diagram was made. We're up to something like 5 million nodes in the mesh now. We're using an unstructured mesh. We're trying to refine the mesh where we have steeper topographic gradients or we have major features such as the Great Lakes or major rivers in order to better capture the gradients and the hydraulic gradients, for example. So let me just quickly show the results from a steady state simulation. That's the spin-up period where we'll compare to, for example, river flows. So here's some major rivers that I'd shown. This is simulated discharge in the rivers at those gauging stations and measured. And you see it's actually really not that bad. And we're going from fairly small rivers all the way up to St. Lawrence and Mackenzie, which are huge flows. Here's a map. As I said, we started out with no surface water in the model. So we have a DEM, we have hydraulic properties, apply rain, let it fill up the depressions, which become lakes, the rivers begin flowing. And this is the simulated pattern of surface water depths. And this is just a cartoon or a map of what actually exists. And it's not a bad correspondence. There are little pits and lakes which we can't capture or probably are false simply because the DEMs are, I mean, the model is very sensitive to the DEM. We could refine as time goes on. This is a long-term project and improve upon some of those features as well. These are essentially lake levels, simulated versus measured. They're pretty much spot on because the bathymetry is pretty much okay. Now, this is what we calculate for this is the exchange flux or infiltration-exfiltration patterns across the land surface from the hydrogeosphere model. And you can see, well, around the fringes, for example, the Great Lakes, it's red, which means it's discharge. Many of the rivers are showing groundwater's discharging. It's feeding the rivers, which makes sense. In other regions, there's infiltration. Some regions, there's essentially nothing happening, no infiltration, exfiltration. This is, for example, where permafrost exists, so that makes sense. I want to contrast this. This is a global climate model. That's CCSM, which you'll read about in IPCC reports, etc. The interesting thing is, in those global models, there is no groundwater. They do a simple 1D Richards equation, infiltration or green amped. Everything goes in down to about 2 meters, then disappears, and essentially becomes rapid runoff to the ocean. So everywhere, it's infiltrating. Well, we know as soil scientists and hydrogeologists that that's not true. So we're hoping to, you know, improve upon the GCMs by, well, eventually burying hydrogeosphere underneath the atmospheric. And if we go a little deeper, groundwater recharge-discharge patterns, it comes out a little more clearly, where it recharges and discharges, or essentially nothing happening. And depths of water table. Again, the Geological Survey of Canada is collecting, after signing agreements with all the provinces, water level data. which we'll be comparing to, but qualitatively, it's pretty much on in the model. Around the St. Lawrence lowlands, it's almost at land surface. Southern Prairie provinces, it's deeper. Southern Ontario, it's quite shallow, so it makes physical sense. And I'll just show you a cross-section across here. It is a 3D model, and here's a flow system. So you can see the lakes. It goes from topographic highs, discharges into lakes in a sort of classical Tothian fashion. How do I advance? Oh, I'm not stuck in an endless loop. Okay. That's a bad thing when you're a modeler, get caught up in an endless do loop. So now let's look at some future climate results. We're going to again use these two models, and it's the A2 scenario climate, which means do nothing, just keep pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, and we're just going to assume here that everything stays the same except for the precipitation. This just shows for the, these are averaged precipitations for these different periods. This is the Canadian climate model, and then this is the WRF model. So you can see on the west coast, in the northwest, it gets much, much wetter. Other regions gets a little bit drier. But as Diana mentioned, there's a lot of uncertainty in these models. And these are two well-respected downscaling climate models. So we are also looking at running different climate models to drive our model, and also within each climate model to run different resolutions in a kind of a Monte Carlo sense, although I wouldn't call it Monte Carlo. The computational effort is so large, we will probably just run a few realizations. So this is the change in the surface water depths. Well, in a lot of places, nothing happens because it's pretty much already at the land surface. It can't go too much above that. But you see the Great Lakes, you know, generally there's agreement. They get a little deeper. And this just shows, if you take WRF, here's some of the lakes here, and this is the, it seems to be cut off, but this is increase in centimeters in lake levels, and that's fairly substantial. And here's changes in the river discharge. Some of them, most of them, in fact, the average river discharge over these periods increases. This caught the attention of some of the oil companies and the Alberta oil sands. One of them, they have these large tailing ponds right on the shore of the Athabasca River, and if you got mean river flows increasing, you park on top of that extreme events, you may be washing away the tailings. So they're interested in us doing some more refined calculations to further explore that. Change in groundwater recharge, well, again, for the different periods between the different models. In a lot of regions, not too much happens, but in some areas, recharge increases fairly significantly because it gets wetter. In other areas, it gets a little bit drier. And this just shows you, we'll just look at the entire domain averaged over the whole Canadian landmass. This is the precipitation change with time, and this is change in recharge and discharge. So you can see it's increasing 10-20%, pretty much in line with Diana's showing in her regional study in this region. So, you know, it is noticeable. Change in water table elevation. Where it gets wetter, it rises. We saw the river flows increasing. In a few areas here, in this region, if you take this period, it's declining, actually quite substantially. That could have implications on crop growing, etc. So just to summarize, we think the modeling is reflecting the large-scale picture in the Canadian water resources. We still have a lot of work to do in comparing to actual data at the present-day model, but it's looking reasonably well. We think an integrated approach is quite meaningful in bringing in more of the physics into the model, and we think that groundwater certainly should be included mechanistically in climate models because it's what feeds lakes and rivers to maintain lake levels and river flows and wetlands, and currently it's not included in the climate models. So with that, thank you.